So Gail and I had the opportunity of being in Israel back in last week of April. And a few weeks ago, I gave a lesson from some of the things that we learned while we were in Israel. We were on a tour, and our tour time was so packed that you really didn't have time to sit and think about things. So showing pictures to friends or captive audiences really makes me think about things. So I've narrowed it down from 8,000 pictures to about 7,835. No, I'm kidding. And some of you may have caught the reference to Wind in the Willows in the title. And others are going, what? So we're going to talk again about Jesus being in Galilee. This is the area of Galilee here. Just to refresh some of your minds for those who were here a few weeks ago, Herod the Great was the builder in Israel. He was the one who, when Jesus was born, wanted to have the children in Bethlehem murdered. He died shortly after that and gave Israel the control of Israel, while the Romans gave control of Israel to Herod's three sons. One was called Herod Archelaus, and he had the area down here called Samaria, and if the map extended down, would be Judea and Jerusalem. Jerusalem, if the map continued down, would be about there. His son, Herod Antipas, had the, had the area of Galilee here. Tiberias was his capital. Capernaum was the city where Jesus was. The Sea of Galilee is where he spent a couple of years of ministry in this area. And then Herod Philip had this area, and he built the city of Caesarea Philippi. We'll talk about that on another time. This is the area called the Decapolis, which was an area settled, given to Greeks from... who's the famous Greek guy? Alexander the Great gave some of his commanders this area of the what they call the Decapolis. So this was an area with great Greek influence. So when we talked the last time, we asked the question of why did Jesus come to Galilee? Why that area? We know that he came at just the right time, but if we think about him coming to earth, if he came to communicate, he should have come now, because this is the time of communication, isn't it? I mean, we had that video that we capture from the internet of that girl and that great story that Erwin shared with us. But why that time and why that area? And we looked at that last time. And Galilee, although it was the area that had the most dense population in Israel at that time, was not the cutting edge. Jerusalem, that's where the religious center was. There were Greek cities in Israel at that time. And they had Greek universities, they had Roman theaters, they had everything that we would consider like the elite. But that's not where Jesus went. He went to this little area called Galilee, and he went to this lake that they called a sea, but was a third of the size of Lake St. Clair. It's 7 miles by 13 miles. So he just went to this little backwater area, and that's where he chose to start the revolution that would change the world. And last time we spoke, I referred to this man, Ray Vanderland. Some of you are familiar with his teaching. You may know the series That the World May Know. You may know another series called Follow the Rabbi. But he talked about why Galilee, and it has to do with discipleship. It has to do with how the teaching was done in Galilee. Now, in modern North America, we think of discipleship the way the Greeks do. That a disciple is somebody who goes and learns from somebody else. So you will go to a university and learn. You might choose a university based on who is teaching. And if you advance in your career, you will choose to go to a certain area because of the expertise there. That's the Greek model. The model in Israel at the time of Jesus and the model that was practiced in Galilee was the disciple wanted to become just like the person who was discipling him, the rabbi. That's the name for a Jewish teacher. So they wanted to walk, talk, eat, drink, sleep, dress the same way as the rabbi did. And if you go to Israel today, you will see different Orthodox Jews walking around, and they wear different hats. They wear the hat of the particular sect of Judaism that they belong to. Some of them are bowlers, some are the little skull caps, and there's this one that looks like like they're from Joe Louis Arena, look like a puck head. We look at it and we think it's very funny, but we're not part of that culture, but they dress like their rabbi. They still do today. Community was also central to life in Galilee. And as Ray Vanderland points out, as Christianity spread into the world at that time, community was essential because they were ostracized. They were actually opposite of everything that was going on in life at that day. And if they didn't live together as a community, they would die. They just wouldn't live. And what did Jesus say about discipleship? Well, he chose a group of 12 to be with him and to spend time with him. And Jesus said, when they were fully trained, they will be like him. Not that they will have gained knowledge from him or have a body of truth that he imparted to them, that they would be like him. It's the Greek model, and that's the model that I follow, that we actually all follow, and we don't know this, but we do, is that we're all individuals. I'm me. That's obvious. But I'm an individual, and that I will go to somebody and learn from that person, and I will gather things that I will take into myself that I will change into being something suitable for me. And then we tend to go it alone. And this is a huge thing for me. And it's a huge thing for most men here, is we think we have to do everything ourselves. I mean, that can be misinterpreted. But that's just how we are. We have that programming in our brain that we should be able to be self-sufficient. And discipleship today has come to mean accountability. What's that mean? Well, if I was in a discipleship group, as is done in most evangelical churches, I would meet with a group of guys to whom I have to give account for my actions. The idea is that my behavior changes, that my inside changes when my behavior changes, and I have to be responsible to Fred and Bob and Jim for my behavior. And I have to tell them what I've done that's wrong. And that's the current model of discipleship in most evangelical churches. We're going to just look at a minute at Capernaum. I took that picture so I could show you. I could actually do what all the kids do naturally, like hold the camera here. Most of my pictures are zoomed into my nose or, you know, pointing up over there, and I'm not even in it. But I got this one right. This is an aerial shot of Capernaum. The city of Capernaum, or the town of Capernaum, there would have been about anywhere from 500 to 1,500 at the time of Jesus, is this area here. This is the Sea of Galilee here. This is a Jesuit friary. That's where the monks live. This is a Greek Orthodox church. In the late 1800s, the site was discovered, and it was bought by these two groups, the Greek Orthodox and the Franciscans. They split the property. The Franciscans built this wall around it to keep the stones from the buildings being stolen. Because if you're building in that area in 1900, what's the easiest way of getting stones is to go to where they already are, pick them up, and take them away. What we see here, this is the synagogue that was built around 400 AD. This is an octagonal church from around 400 AD. This is a Christian church, and that's built over the site of Peter's house. We're not going to talk about that. This is a house. This is an insula-style house. This is another one. This is another one. This is a series of insula-style houses. The Jewish house at that time was a walled courtyard onto which you attached rooms around the courtyard, and in there would live different families. So there might be four or five families or even more living in this compound. This space right here between this octagonal thing and this space is about 70 feet. And in there would be a group of families living in that kind of area. This is a floor plan of Peter's house from the time of Jesus. Now, archaeologists, I think, are right about this. It's a two courtyards and a series of rooms, and we want to remember that in this complex, which is about 1,000 square feet, lived Peter and his wife and whoever family he had, we don't know. Andrew, his brother, probably married, and whatever family he had, Peter's mother-in-law, and various times the disciples. And at one point, we also know that Mary and Jesus's family were also living in that little compound right there. And as I was thinking about this, as I thought of living in this kind of community, it reminded me that our families are all full of warts and wrinkles and idiosyncrasies. And we just get along because we're family, don't we? That's the model for Christianity. Is we get along because we are blood, we are family, and we tend to cut each other slack in families a lot more than we do in real life. So that's where I put this little comment right here. So this area, like I said, is about 1,000 square feet, including two courtyards and the buildings where they lived, and it's in between the synagogue and the lake, and is about 80 feet, including streets, away from the synagogue. This is a model of what Capernaum might look like, except I would make some exceptions. The stones were black basalt, and they were uncut stones, so they were just piled up into a wall. They didn't use cement or mortar, because that was too expensive, and they didn't plaster over the outside, like we see pictures of houses that look gleaming white. It wouldn't have been that, and basalt is black. So it probably would be kind of dreary looking, and it wouldn't be two stories high. Because to get something those stones going up two stories, you would have to use a lot of cement. This is a picture of the partial walls of the village of Capernaum. This is taken from the synagogue, and I just wanted you to note, this street between the synagogue and this building is about 6 feet wide. This one's maybe 10 feet, 15 feet wide. This is one insular building, this is another. So they lived in these close communities on top of each other, and into this community is where Jesus came to create disciples and change the world. We're going to talk about two storms on the Sea of Galilee and two crossings on the Sea of Galilee. So this is a map of the northern part, or the area of the Sea of Galilee. What's interesting is that Jesus spent not only his time in this area, but as far as I can read, he never went further south on the Sea of Galilee than about this line across here. Magdala is the fishing village where Mary of Magdalene came from. Gergesa is the area that's called the Gerasenes or the Gerasenes. It depends on which gospel you read, but that's about the area here. This is the beginning of what's called the Decapolis. This is the Greek area. Bethsaida is the town where John and his brother James and Peter and Andrew came from. There's Capernaum, there's Chorazin. These are all within 3 miles of each other. So we're going to read in Matthew 14. I've got all the scripture on the overhead if you just want to follow there. So Matthew 14, this is the second storm on the Sea of Galilee. So we're going in reverse order. Matthew 14, immediately, Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. After he had dismissed them, he went up on the mountainside by himself to pray. Later that night, he was alone, and the boat was already a considerable distance from land, buffeted by the waves because of the wind against it. Shortly before dawn, Jesus went out to them, walking on the lake. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage, it is I. Don't be afraid." "Jew," replied Peter, "tell me to come to you on the water." "Come," he said. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately, Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. "You have little faith. Why did you doubt?" And when they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." When they crossed over, they landed at Gennesaret. Now we're just going to read the other account, the other storm I want to talk about, and that's in Mark. So Mark 4, verse 35. That day, when evening came, he said to his disciples, "Let us go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along, just as he was, in the boat. There were also other boats with him. A furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." Then the wind died down and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" They were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." So we have two boat crossings. Jesus had many more. Two storms, but they're different storms. This is, again, just to show you where we are. This is Capernaum. The Mount of Beatitudes, or where the Sermon on the Mount was, is just a little bit beyond, outside of Capernaum. This is the town called Chorazin, and that's Bethsaida. You've heard about that. The feeding of the 5,000, which is when the first story that we read in Mark, where Peter walked on the water, occurred around here, and they were getting in their boat to go to Capernaum, up here, and they got blown backwards and ended up here in a place called Gennesaret. The second story, again, they're leaving from about this area right here, and they're going across to here, and they go right to where they were wanting to go, but there was a storm that came up. This is a picture taken from the Mount of Beatitudes, up on where the Sermon on the Mount was given, looking out the length of the Dead Sea. And you can see it, 13 miles. That's to the very south end. It was a cloudy day the day we were there. This is looking west towards Tiberias. So this was a city that is a modern city now, still called Tiberias, but was the capital of that area called Galilee. It was built by Herod and Antipas. That's where John the Baptist was killed. But we're looking from there across the Sea of Galilee. This is looking the other way. This is where demon-possessed man in Gennesaret, no, wrong place, Gerasenes was. And that's where they were going on the second story that I read. This is looking towards Capernaum. This is the village of Capernaum between these two buildings. That's the Greek Orthodox Church. That's the Jesuit Church. Bethsaida would be back over here, probably about here. And then where we were talking about the Gerasenes or Gerasenes, whichever you want to say, was probably to the right of this spot. This is from the Sea of Galilee. What we're looking at here, this is the pass in the mountain that was the road from Nazareth to this area. This is looking from the sea, looking up the Mount of Beatitudes, or where the Sermon on the Mount was. We're looking over this area here is where the two miraculous catches occurred of fish, right in this area. That's a model of what the boat would be like at that time. They actually found one that's about 2,000 years old. This is a model that was built. Probably the ones Jesus was in may have been a little bigger than that. So we read the account of Peter walking on the water. Jesus had just fed 5,000 people. At the end of the time, he sends his disciples out on the boat and says, "I'm going up the mountain to pray." So he went up the hill, the disciples went out, they probably went around sunset to row a couple of miles up the lake to go to Capernaum. In Mark, we see details that we didn't see in Matthew. And Mark, if you remember, was written by Mark. But Peter is the one who's telling Mark what to write. So Mark is writing the stories that Peter has given. And there's some interesting details. And that was, Jesus saw them. Well, you go, how did he see them? Well, actually, if you're there, you could see almost everything on the lake when you're up a hill. And it always puzzled me about how Jesus would get in a boat and start to cross, and the people would be there before he got there. Well, because they could see where he was going, and it would be, oh, they're going to Bethsaida, and they'd run ahead and get to Bethsaida. Oh, they're going to, you know, Magdala, so they'd run ahead and get to Magdala. And that never made sense to me till you actually stand there and you say, well, you know, I can walk faster than somebody can row a big boat. And this is what's interesting, is you read commentaries about the Sea of Galilee. Everybody talks about big storms that blow up on the Sea of Galilee. And they'll talk about a wind coming from the Mediterranean and meeting a wind that's coming from across the desert, or something coming down out of Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon is 9,000 feet tall, and it's maybe 10 miles to the north. And they talk about this being an area of storms. Now just keep that in mind. So in Matthew 14, they were rowing into a strong wind, and being good rowers, they ended up going in the opposite direction and landing the opposite distance from where they were trying to go. I just find that funny. Why'd Peter get out of the boat? Why in the world would you do that? So, let's get the scene. We know from Mark that it's between 3 and 6 in the morning. So it's still dark. They're out on the lake. These are guys who probably did not know how to swim. Maybe they did. I don't know if you realize the front crawl that we all do was only invented 100 years ago, or maybe 120. But they didn't know how to swim. The lake was an unknown thing to them. They actually called it the abyss. On the other side of the lake from where they were was the Greek area. There was a city called Hippos, which is up on the hill. I understand that demon worship was very big in Hippos and the Greek area. Why did Peter get out of the boat? They thought Jesus was a ghost. What else are you going to think? I mean, if I was out there, I'm not thinking, oh, it's got to be Jesus. And the funny thing is, when you read the account in Mark, is Jesus was going to walk past them. See you later, guys. I'll see you over there. I mean, I don't know if he was doing that. What was the reason Jesus was doing that? It's just so weird. Why did Peter get out of the boat? Well, what did we say a disciple does? He wants to be the rabbi. He wants to walk like the rabbi, talk like the rabbi, eat like the rabbi, sleep where the rabbi sleeps. For Peter, I think it was just logical. The rabbi is out in the water. I should be able to walk on the water. I mean, it's just amazing that his concept of becoming like Jesus was that he would be able to walk on water. That to me is just too amazing to understand. That's what Peter thought his job was to do, was to become like Jesus. Mark 4, it's a different storm. This is the storm where Jesus is in the boat. He spent a day of teaching. He starts in Mark with teaching the parable of the sowers. And in there, you read through the different parables, and Jesus explains the parables to his disciples. Because his disciples were sitting in the boat, Jesus was in the front of the boat, the crowd was up on the shore. And it's an interesting thing, if you want to do a search on the internet, somebody has gone to the area where he thinks Jesus did this. And I guess the area has natural acoustics. I don't understand that stuff. But he has a recording of somebody speaking on shore, and he's way up the hill, and he can hear everything that's going on. How that happened, we don't need to worry about that. But Jesus, at the end of the day, says, let's go to the other side. The disciples don't know why, but that was their job. And then a furious storm comes up, and I don't read Greek, but I can read people who read Greek. And they said it's a hurricane. It's not just a storm. In Matthew 14, when Peter walks on the water, it's a strong wind. This is a full-blown, I wouldn't call it a tornado, but a full-blown hurricane blowing through the Sea of Galilee. And Jesus, I don't know how, is sleeping in the back of the boat. And the boat's taking on water. I mean, they all have to be soaking wet. We're not talking of a 40-foot, you know, cabin cruiser. They're all soaking wet. There's storm. There's rain. There's everything going on, and Jesus is sound asleep. So this storm is different than the contrary wind, which is what the Bible says it was in Matthew 14. And the disciples wake Jesus up and say to him, "Don't you care?" And then Jesus does something that I think is strange. He rebukes the wind. And in all three accounts, the same phrase is. Peter walking on the water in Matthew 14 is in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. This one is in Matthew, John, and Mark. But all three say Jesus rebuked the wind. That seems, to me, weird. The same word is used in a bunch of other places. Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be quiet and come out of him." And when the unclean spirit had convulsed him and cried out with a loud voice, he came out of him. That's the first miracle in Mark that is recorded of Jesus. And that occurs in the synagogue. This is Mark 3. "And the unclean spirits, whenever they saw him, fell down before him and cried out, saying, 'You are the Son of God.' But he rebuked them, that they should not make him known. When Jesus saw that the people came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit." This is where the disciples were unable to heal the boy, and the boy's father came to Jesus and said, "Why can't your disciples do this?" "He rebuked the unclean spirit, saying, 'Deaf and dumb spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him no more.'" Jesus rebuked the wind. So this word is also used when Jesus is speaking to other people and his disciples. When Peter makes his proclamation to Jesus and says, "You are the Christ," and Jesus then says to his disciples, "I'm going to be killed," and Peter takes him aside and he rebukes Jesus. He says, "No, you're not going to do this." And Jesus in turn rebukes Peter. This is a word that's used for other people, but last time I checked, the wind was an inanimate object. I don't know if there's any significance in this, but Gail and I, a couple of times, have gone. Some of you who are older will know Michael Card, the singer. He also is a Bible teacher, and we've gone a couple of times to a weekend seminar he's done where he goes through a gospel. In his book, this book, The Gospel of Passion, Michael Card says this wasn't a regular storm. This was a demonic attack. I don't know what to say about that. But why would Jesus rebuke the wind? So the disciples at the beginning of the ministry are all in a boat and Jesus. And did Satan go after them? I don't know. I have trouble with that. And I have trouble with this. I mean, every time Jesus turns around, there's demons. I don't understand that. To my mind, trained like, I guess you could say, out of Greek tradition, that doesn't make any sense. The end of chapter 1 in Mark, he drove out many demons. When he gathered the 12, as we read already in Mark 3, he took them up the hill. He gave them authority to cast out demons. I go through my everyday life acting as if demons don't exist. What's that say? That it's hard to read a couple of chapters of the Bible. I mean, he healed, three blind men. I don't know how many demons he cast out. So I thought about that. Why do we act as if demons don't exist? Well, we live in a Christian country, you know, those third world countries. That's where demons are, because we're civilized. We don't have them. You know, I don't know how many years ago, the guy wrote the book, piercing the darkness, about demon warfare and all those things. I think he did something in that book that was probably wrong. He portrayed demons as gargoyles that you see on a cathedral. He painted them as caricatures. I've forgotten his name. Mick Jagger. I don't think he's much of a theologian. But one of his songs, called Sympathy for the Devil, he calls Satan a man of wealth and taste. Which one is a more accurate view of what a demon is like? And we go through our lives acting as if there is only one force in action. God is on our side. Now, you know, there are people, and this is a phrase I heard from somebody else, who see a demon behind every red light and an angel in front of every empty parking spot. But I've gone to the other extreme where this stuff just doesn't exist. So here's a question. 2,000 years ago, Jesus came to earth. Why did every time Jesus turn around, were there demons? So which one of these pictures would accurately portray what the incarnation was like? So was the incarnation a joyously awaited birth that everybody celebrated? Or was it D-Day? Oops. We forget. Jesus was invading enemy territory. When Satan took him up on the mountain, to show him all the kingdoms of the world, that wasn't fake. That was real. So in our minds, which is the incarnation? What do we think about Jesus coming to earth? Does it make sense that Jesus turns around and every time he goes somewhere, there are demons waiting for him? I don't know. I don't have the answer. I'm just raising this question. I find it very interesting that Mark, in his gospel, during the time when Peter walked on the water, which interestingly enough is left out of Mark's gospel, Peter didn't want people to know he actually walked on water. You know, sometimes people say it was because he was embarrassed. No, it wasn't because he was embarrassed. He's the only person who's ever walked on water. But it's interesting, the explanation. Jesus climbed into the boat with them and the wind died down. They were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. Peter, looking back 30 years after the event, is saying, you know what? We didn't understand that there were spiritual factors or spiritual forces involved. We didn't understand that Jesus was God, that just like God fed the children of Israel in the desert with manna, he just fed 5,000 people. We didn't get that. They didn't see anything beyond the immediate physical, so they understood nothing about the spiritual thing, that the spiritual aspect of life that Jesus was bringing in. Kind of like us, you know? We don't get it. Or maybe I'm the only one. So what do we do? And this is where I have difficulty. We try to make the Christian life suit our life, right? I want to be a disciple of somebody who will make my life easier and make it work out better for me. That's what I want. I want to learn some tips about making my marriage work better, and maybe me get along better with my kids, maybe advance my career, and that's what I want out of Christianity. And what about Jesus' model for discipleship? What about Jesus' model for community? And by mold, I don't mean green stuff growing on your food. I mean the other mold. So I've many times, and this is a thought that I've had for many years, I don't know where it came from, but as I walk further along, I realize how true it is I know what it is to be an evangelical in a 20th century life in North America. I don't know what it is to be a Christian. And I don't even know what to do with this. So Peter walked on water. You know, I've heard the story, or I've heard messages where Peter wanted to be with Jesus because it was safer. Or Peter wanted to walk on water because if the rabbi's out there, I should be there. And then what did Jesus do after he rebuked the storm? He lands on the shore and he casts a demon out of somebody in the middle of enemy territory. And I don't know the answer to this last one. So Gail always tells me I got to have a point. And you know, I've got this cartoon and this minister's in front of a congregation. He says, in response to last week's 27-point message, this message will be pointless. But I don't think, at least in my life, I need three keys to understanding my marriage or four things to make me a better dad. I need to know, how do I walk like Jesus walked? How do I get out of the boat when the rabbi is out on the water? How do I recognize what is spiritual warfare? Because it's around me all the time. It's just the demons are men of wealth and taste rather than gargoyles. And I don't have the answers. But you know what? I'm not what I was 10 years ago. And I'm not what I'm going to be in 10 years. And none of us actually are. We're all in process. We're all walking a journey on a pathway. And hopefully, we are walking in, to borrow Ray Vanderland's term, the rabbi's footsteps. Let's close in prayer. Father, we really are all on a journey. None of us are standing still. Maybe some of us have been going downstream for a long time. We've not been going in the direction you want us to go. You wanted us to row against the waves, and we just got blown backwards. But we're all on a journey. We can't do the journey without you, and we can't do the journey without each other. And we don't really know what tomorrow brings. And we don't really, at least I don't think I know what it is to live a Christ life. But you know, Lord Jesus, you know. And you want us to come. We think of the disciples when they followed you and you turned to them and said, what do you want? And they said, where do you live? I guess that's what we want. We want to live where you live. Amen.